The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Have the changes in the banking industry affected you? With the looming possibility that your local bank branch might disappear and more web, mobile, and social technologies, what will the changes mean for you and your business? Welcome to Breaking Banks with your host, Brett King. The possibility that banking is no longer a place you go, but just something that you do, has become very real. Now, here is Brett King.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. And this week, we're not coming from New York. We're not coming from London or Hong Kong or anywhere else like that. We're coming from Bali. It's the 4th of February, and we're going out on AM 1160 in Voice of America. I'm Andy McLean. I'm sitting in for Brett King, your regular host, who's off on a silent meditation retreat. Not often you get Brett silent, but there you go. We've managed it this week. Coming up on the show, we're going to talk about my startup bank challenge here in Bali. We're going to hear from Kieran Flanagan and Dan Gregory on their book, Selfish, Scared, and Stupid, which probably sums me up. We're going to have an interview from our roving correspondent, Brett King, with Dan Kimmerling, the Chief Everything Officer at Standard Treasury. I caught up with DJ Dodonna here in Bali, so we'll hear from him. He's running a startup that uses psychometric credit scoring. And as usual, Ron Shevlin will give his moment of snark. But first of all, I just want to actually introduce the guy sitting next to me is Peter Wall, the co-founder of a co-working space here in Ubud called Hubud, who's going to be joining me on the show. Peter, how is it that you've come to be doing what you're doing?
Well, hi, Andy. First of all, nice to be on the show. Look, I think cities are becoming less and less important than they once were. And why not open a co-working space in Bali?
Excellent, Peter. Now, so going back to the startup bank challenge, I actually stumbled across this idea by accident when I was going to Singapore last month to get my visa for Indonesia. And I had lunch with Rob Finley of Next Bank. Rob's joining us on the line now. And Rob, look, let's just start off by having a little bit about, what is Next Bank all about? What's kind of your mantra, if you like?
Thanks, Andy. Well, Next Bank's really, a group of people coming together to try and create some positive change in banking. And we do that through, building a community. We do it through events and conferences, which we've done all over the world for the last couple of years. And we're really trying to really interact with all the different participants of the banking ecosystem and bring them together in an equal democratic way. So slowly building, hopefully, to an interesting point in our brand and getting people involved all over the world.
Awesome. And I read a post by Chris Skinner, who's fairly well known in sort of banking circles, and he talked about a debate that you ran on the five biggest issues in banking. Can you tell us a little bit about what everyone had to say?
Yeah, well, it was pretty interesting. So we put it out to, a group of people who we all think have got some good things to say. And what I was really struck by, the point of the question to start with was to sort of try and narrow down where we should look at and what topics and themes we should play with in the Next Bank community. But the really interesting thing for me about what came back was the variety of issues that people thought was in those top three or five challenges. They ranged from regulation to culture to technical challenges to customer, awareness or engagement or interest in the sector. And many of those things, when you put them together into a large list, which Chris did a great job of in his blog post, they're not insignificant challenges to overcome for the industry. I think we all knew that, but it was good to sort of list them down and say, these are all the things the industry, as an incumbent industry, needs to confront. So I think that's what really Next Bank, and I'm sure you guys are really here to do.
So, I mean, what's your motivation to support something like, it was actually your idea, so, what's your motivation to support some sort of, wacky venture of starting up a bank in Bali? Like, What sort of makes that special over, say, you know, supporting an accelerator or something like that?
Well, I think it's there's very much incremental innovation in banking, and then there's extreme innovation, and I think the industry has tended towards incremental too often. It's not to say that accelerators and incubators aren't doing progressive, interesting, forward-looking things. It's just that I wonder and I worry that if the outcome is, you know, a single idea that fits one function, that we're just going to get a lot of single apps and ideas out there. So yeah, I think we need to find a way to have both incubators and accelerators and people who can do good things in small and medium-sized ways. But I wanted Next Bank to be bold and to take on those things that no one else would take on. And I think, you know, I wonder if we're really solving the business model and the long-term future of the industry if we just keep chipping away at the tiny 1% changes. So why don't we look at those top five challenges and try and solve the big, bold things? We've got nothing to lose, really. And the idea was, if you're going to run a bank that's for the future and for this really brand-new age that 30 years ago was pretty different to today, you need to start from scratch in a way, even more than just creating something over the top of the existing industry. You need to start from the bottom up for this very new generation of consumers and small businesses that really are getting very used to dealing with interacting with information in a very different way. So that was the challenge.
That's excellent, Rob. Well, look, thanks very much for joining us here on Breaking Banks, and really, really excited about this possible venture. Of course, we've got a website that will be it's up and live now. It's barley.startupbankchallenge.com. You can obviously be contacted through Next Bank. Really happy to have you on the show, and looking forward to working with you over the coming few weeks.
Good luck, Andy. I expect big, big things from you all down there, and I want to see your name and brand and movement up in lights very soon. And thanks for having me on the show. Good luck.
I'm now going to go back to Peter. You know, so Peter, you know, you've been here in Ubud for quite some time now. I suppose, what types of people does a place like Ubud and your co-working space Hubud attract?
Well, I think the one commonality amongst the people that are in Ubud and in Hubud in terms of expats that have moved here are they're people that have left conventional work behind. So they're people who are trying to do new and different things, and some of them come for a month, some of them come for the rest of their lives. It's really a diverse group of people. In the co-working space itself, we obviously have a lot of people who are working in tech, a lot of what we call digital nomads, and this Next Bank venture sounds like it would be an interesting project for, or an interesting opportunity for digital nomads. So digital nomads, and they can be, you know, people with online businesses, people with creative professionals such as designers. We get a lot of web programmers, computer programmers. So it's a mix of people who basically can have felt like working in the West wasn't working for them, and they wanted to try something new.
I mean, one thing I'm really, really interested about is, you know, what do you think it is about sort of like Ubud and Bali that's so powerful as a place of creativity and innovation? I mean, for instance, you know, we've got a Bitcoin community popping up here. What is it about the place? Because for me, innovation is all about creating the conditions and getting that right. So just give me some thoughts on that.
I think the thing about Bali that is unique, I think, is that the cost of failure here is very low. And that comes across in a number of different ways. Obviously, in a bricks and mortar sense, you know, the cost of living is cheaper, the cost of starting up a new business is cheaper. But, you know, a lot of our members here at Hubud are not doing bricks and mortar businesses, they're doing tech businesses. And I think their attitude, their psychological attitude towards trying something new when they're not in their home city, when they're not in their home country, when they're not around their friends and family, is that it's okay for me to try something new. It's okay for me to fail. It's okay for me to step outside of the box because I am literally not in my normal place. So I think that's where a lot of the creativity comes from.
I mean, that's amazing language. I mean, if you think about a bank, which I've obviously worked for, I mean, the idea of it's okay to fail, it's just it's nonsensical actually in a place like that. But now we're getting on to why I want to actually try the Startup Bank Challenge in Bali, because it's almost like the Harvard students we had here a few weeks ago. They made that point, is at that design stage, you don't need the access to capital. You know, you don't need those big partnerships. It's just the creativity to get the idea right. And I think it's probably a good opportunity to bring in another one of our colleagues, Gary Dykstra. You know, Gary, I'm really, really interested in your thoughts. I mean, you're setting up a Bitcoin community here, but I like your ideas about what you think banking is at the moment and what it probably should be. So I'm just really keen to get your thoughts on that, which might be a lead into our Startup Bank Challenge, you know, the sorts of ideas. This is Gary Dykstra, of course, who was on Breaking Banks a month or so ago.
Thanks, Andy. Well, you know, we are trying to get a Bitcoin community going here, and the reason for that is the problems with the incumbent global monetary system, of which banking is a part. So I really feel like the entire system is being rethought at this point, Bitcoin being money, but banking to go along with it. There's all kinds of base premises that one can question when you're starting from scratch and you're building a parallel system, a system that's totally out of the mainstream.
I mean, Gary, one of the things I love on the internet at the moment is Bank of Dave. You know, so it's a guy in Burnley in England who just thought it can't be that hard to do banking properly. I mean, I know you sort of share similar views.
Yes, I think that banking has become way too complicated. If you think about what banks are really trying to do, it's not that hard. And I think if we get back to basics, if we really think about what we're really trying to do and not about all these technical things, derivatives and you know, credit default swaps and all of these technical things that nobody understands, if you get back to basics, I think you could succeed that way.
Yeah, I mean, what I love about Bank of Dave is he says, well, I'm going to pay you 5% for your deposits. You come into the bank, you know, you put your money down, put the cash in the kind of the safe, and then he goes out and actually visits customers and looks at their businesses and says, yeah, actually, I can see how this works. I'll lend to you at, you know, 8 or 9% or whatever. I mean, isn't that what that's sort of like the whole ethos of supporting the community? And I mean, I know you've spoken a bit about this, you know, at various events, but banking seems to have gone a long way from supporting the community.
Well, you think about the, at least in the United States, the community bank, right? You've got the community banker who is a pillar of the community and, you know, the steward of the community savings, and then figuring out where those community savings can best be applied in the community. So you've got, every Tom, Dick, and Harry, every family, you know, saving their money in the bank. And then the business owners and prospective business owners coming to the bank and saying, I've got this idea, you know, let's build a bridge, let's build a lighthouse, let's do something for the community, may we borrow this money from the community to do this thing. That way, you know, the resources of the entire community are correctly allocated. The savings are going to something that does something good, and the people who have good ideas have the money to do it with.
And I'm going to go back to Peter now. I mean, Peter, as a, you know, as a startup founder yourself, you know, you've set up a co-working space, and you know, you've kind of started things over again. I mean, what's your sort of take on something like this idea to start a bank in Bali? I mean, are we completely off our heads here, or do you think this is something that could be, you know, done in a few weeks' time with a bit of focus, come up with a solid concept and try and, you know, get our way into an accelerator, or am I completely bloody mad?
Well, one of my favorite things to say about Indonesia is that the best thing about Indonesia is that anything is possible. The worst thing about Indonesia is that anything is possible. So look, I've spent some hours, I would say days, but it's certainly many hours waiting in line at the bank here. There's definitely lots of room for innovation, I think, in banking, particularly for people like myself who are living as an expat in not my original country, you know, move around the world a lot, paying taxes in different jurisdictions. For sure, I would be interested in a bank that is innovative and different from the ones I'm currently using.
And so actually, you know, what we're wanting to do is we're wanting to bring a bunch of people here. I see my producer Rachel is asking me what's going to be different. And I think the point of difference actually is that we're trying to do it completely differently. Now, normally what happens in banking is you get together, you go into a room, you put together a sort of like a whiteboard, You sort of draw it out, you know, you put all your thinking together, and then you go away, and then you come back a week later or a few weeks later or whatever it might be, and you regroup. And in the meantime, there's a whole lot of other stuff going on, and that's why actually banks struggle to innovate, because essentially it's about the people. So our idea is actually just to bring a whole bunch of people, you know, like from Next Bank or anyone else who's kind of dissatisfied and wants to make a difference in that, you know, in their own profession. We want to bring them here, but we also want a bunch of creatives, people who are actually customers of banks today, like Peter Wall, who we're speaking to right here, coming here and saying, yeah, I reckon I can design it, because it can't be that difficult to actually get it right. Innovation is all about, I mean, in my opinion, getting the conditions right. And I think we have them here. And I'm very happy to have Peter on the show, Peter Wall, the founder of Hubud, the co-working space, and Gary Dykstra, who's one of the guys who's setting up a little Bitcoin community here. We've got our own Bitcoin ATM. So I've touched a lot on the show about the Startup Bank Challenge. So just the quick details on that. Go to barley.startupbankchallenge.com. If you want to get in touch with me, it's Andy McLean on the Twitter handle Insane McLean. That's MCLEAN. And also, if you want to find out any other information, get in touch with Next Bank on Twitter. It's all there. Can't wait to have people come and speak to us. Join us now, and as soon as possible, let's get this thing going. Coming up towards the first ad break here on Breaking Banks, just a reminder, I'm Andy McLean, sitting in for Brett King. After that, we're going to be going into a new interview with a couple of guys looking at their new book, here on Breaking Banks.
Your bank's customers expect comprehensive, convenient, and consistent service when and where they need it. A mobile app is a great start, but with so many devices and operating systems out there, it can be hard to keep up with demand. That's why today's leading banks count on the Kony Multichannel Experience Cloud. With Kony, you can design, develop, and manage multi-channel apps from one integrated platform. Build an app once, and with one click, you can deploy it securely across all digital channels, phones, tablets, desktop, and more. That means more efficient for you and a better experience for your customers. Want to get to market fast? Explore Kony's range of ready-to-run apps, including retail, commercial, and private banking, with features like person-to-person transfers, targeted campaigns, built-in integrations, and cutting-edge compliance. Kony apps provide the framework and flexibility you need to rise above the competition. Go beyond first-generation mobile banking. Visit kony.com/BK to launch your multi-channel strategy. That's KONY.com/BK.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here. And it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Move In is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Move In today.
Time. There's never enough. You just don't have the time to search out all the latest banking innovations from around the world. But the good news is, we've already done it for you at Banking Reports. 700 hours of research goes into each edition of our Global Banking Innovation Monitor. Be smarter and get one step ahead. Get Banking Reports sent quarterly to your inbox. To subscribe, follow us on Twitter at banking_reports.
The successful businesses of today do everything they can to meet the needs of their customers. But outdated IT systems mean that banks often struggle to offer the same level of personalized service. SunTech is working with some of the world's leading banks to help them provide the products, offers, and services that their customers need and want. Visit suntechgroup.com to find out more. That's suntechgroup.com.
Thank you.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. And now you're going to hear from Kieran Flanagan and Dan Gregory on their book, Selfish, Scared, and Stupid.
So we're here with Dan Gregory and Kieran Flanagan. They are the authors of a brand new book out by Wiley called Selfish, Scared, and Stupid, Stop Fighting Human Nature and Increase Your Performance, Engagement, and Influence. So, Dan, first of all, I welcome you to the show. We'll get to Kieran in a moment. Welcome to New York.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
So you're originally from Oz. You travel
originally
the world.
From Australia. Travel the world, yeah. Spent a lot of time, you know, like yourself, in airports. So I really live a little bit over the Pacific Ocean.
Yes, yeah, 33,000 feet or 38,000 after they burn the fuel off. So so tell me about what inspired you to write Selfish, Scared, and Stupid.
Well, I think, you know, we've obviously consumed a lot of business books over the years, and we've learned a lot about, you know, how business gets done in our own personal careers. And I think what we found was there was a huge disconnect. There was a gap between what people said they did and what they actually did. In other words, you know, we have certain views about what drives human behavior. And to a large extent, they're built around ideals. They're built around, you know, the way we'd like to see ourselves as opposed to the way that we really react, you know. And given, you know, we've been a part of some really successful campaigns at home, like, you know, the most successful new product launch in Australian history and some international launches around the world. And what we found was what people said was driving them didn't show up in their behavior, didn't show up in the real world. So that's what we really looked at is what is the core motivator or the core series of motivators that are driving our behavior. And what we found was our survival brain, the most primitive part of our brain, actually calls dibs on most of our decision making. And that led us to Selfish, Scared, and Stupid.
Right. I remember actually doing some observational research where we would look at people with new designs of new branch spaces and new ATM locations, things like that, and see how people responded. And it was very, very funny. You know that tendency to queue up behind ATMs?
Yeah.
You know, where people, and you're worried about people sort of shoulder surfing, right? So, and we found that if we painted a yellow line on the floor, about half the people would queue behind the yellow line. But if we put a barrier, you know, like a steel barrier, then everybody would queue up behind it, you know. So
it's levels of obedience. But you're exactly right. And we have this, I mean, we were talking about it earlier when we speak to audiences. We ask them the question, you know, who here thinks that saving their money is a good idea? And unanimously an entire audience will say yes. But if we ask them the question, who here has more voluntary savings than, say, forced savings? And forced savings are things like your mortgage or your superannuation or 401k. Those are forced savings. Yeah. And most people overwhelmingly have more savings in that capacity than they do in, say, shares or their own investment accounts. So there is this disconnect. And what we've found is by understanding this disconnect, by understanding what's truly driving human human nature, really, and aligning our strategies and our processes such that they work with that human nature, we actually, you know, have a better chance of achieving success than trying to change human behavior, which is really difficult.
Absolutely. Now, Kieran, maybe I'll toss this one at you and get your opinion on this. We talk a lot about the behavioral shift between millennials and, you know, the previous generations. When it comes to human nature, are there certain things which pass from generation to generation, or are there certain things that have sort of a generational bent to them where you start to see, you know, new behaviors emerge among groups of people?
Yeah, Brett. Look, I think it's a really interesting question, and we've spent a bit of time looking at that. And so much of media attention these days is given to the differences. You know, we talk about the changes and what matters,
like,
and
millennials,
values.
Gen-wise,
you know, they don't, you know, the first generation to ever rate meaning ahead of money, which we're seeing. But ultimately, our base natures and what fundamentally drives us is unchanging. And in one of our advertising, our career began in advertising, and you know, there's a guy called Bill Birnbach who's a godfather of advertising, and his thinking way back in the 50s was all around unchanging man. And that there's certain drivers that are very fundamental, you know, the need to feel loved, the need to be listened to, you know, the need to fit in. These things still fundamentally drive millennials. They drive Gen X, they drive Gen Y, they drive boomers. You know, we're all driven by these very base desires. And for us, selfish, scared and stupid applies to everybody. You know, it's again, it doesn't go away because it's part of the reason we survived as species. Selfish meant we looked out for number one. We kept ourselves alive and our loved ones. Scared meant that, you know, we laid low in times of danger. And stupid meant we looked for the easiest and simplest way to get something done. And a necessity isn't the mother of all invention. It's laziness.
Right.
You know, we didn't need hot running water.
Sure.
You know, part of the world still doesn't have it. But someone went, you know what? Walking I'd to the like well it. Every day, yeah, it takes a lot
and
of
it's
work.
Cold
it's
and-
cold, it's miserable, it's heavy. What if we brought it to ourselves? So, you know, it's that laziness that's constantly drives us. And that is unchanging in people.
So part of the book talks about how to game behavior. How to reward people for and sort of changing them. So maybe, Dan, what are some of the techniques that you can use to get people to change the way they behave? So yeah. When they're doing things that are negative and the classics like saving money or you know, getting a diet or getting healthy after New Year's. And
yeah. Well, I think those are the critical issues. And one of the things that we've found, and particularly, you know, it's January while we're talking. So at this early time of the year, people are very much in a goal planning phase or a resolution setting phase. And what we found is that people are usually really optimistic at this time of right. the year. And that
hopelessly optimistic.
That doesn't always translate into being realistic.
Right.
And what we found is that it's not just about setting goals. You know, it's also about how do you build your environment? How do you build your systems such that the outcome you want to achieve becomes more likely? And gamification is certainly a way of doing that. You know, when you gamify a process, you make it more enjoyable, it's more personally satisfying, and that sort of biases you towards, you know, wanting to engage with it. But I think, you know, the critical thing is to understand what are the friction points.
Yep.
And there are friction points whether you're a leader trying to motivate a team to do a particular task. There are friction points in a sale, for instance. And so it's about understanding what those friction points are and how you can mitigate those friction points, but also create a way of making the desired behavior more likely. And, you know, we tend to talk about, you know, when we sit with, we do a lot of work with organizations, helping them, you know, do process design and team design, and essentially, you know, help them design behavior that they'd like to see. And what
can
we
you
look
give
to
us
do,
an example?
Yeah. So an example of that is one of the, we were recently at an IKEA in Australia, and one of the great things they do. So anywhere in the world, when it starts raining, you know what happens to the price of umbrellas?
Yeah.
The price of umbrellas goes up. It doubles. Well, at this particular IKEA, what they had done is the management at the IKEA had created a sign that had handwritten in chalk. So it looked like they'd just thought of it. But it was a sign that they just kept in a storeroom. And the sign read, as you walked into the foyer, it's raining outside, so we've cut the price of our umbrellas in half for you. Now, it looked like an incredibly thoughtful thing to do, and it was. But the thoughtfulness wasn't something that happened in the moment. It was pre-planned thoughtfulness. Mm. And what they'd done is they'd trained their staff to actually, when it starts raining, your job is to put that sign in the foyer. Now, you know, we spend so much time working with customer service staff saying, you know, you need to greet the customer with your eyes first, you need to smile from the inside, all that kind of stuff that they forget the moment they've finished the training day. What these guys had done is they'd systematized thoughtfulness. And that's what we're looking to do is how do we systematize the kind of actions that we need them to perform so that even if they're not having a good day, even if they're not our best employee, how do we have them show up as if they were? Mm. That's what we're looking to do.
So, Karen, maybe I'll direct this one back at you. You know, we obviously at Breaking Banks, we have a lot of banking professionals and increasingly fintech people looking at incorporating technology into the experience. And is there a way that you see technology changing our behavior in good and negative ways in terms of the way, like, you know, we talk about people spending, you know, 80% of millennials, the first thing they do it in the morning and the last thing they do at night is check their phone. And there's a lot of focus on things like that. But where do you see the positives and negatives of the technology play?
Wow. Well, you know, I have a 6-year-old daughter, so it's fascinating to watch someone grow up with technology in their hand. Digital native. And, you know, for me, watching her and watching the biggest shift we're seeing is that I need it now to happen. It's so strong in people that waiting as a concept, you know, our impatience is on the rise.
Right.
I think we're hugely impatient, given that human beings naturally are selfish. You know, what's in it for me? It's how quickly can I get it? And our tolerance, even for download speeds, you know, nothing is ever fast enough. Yeah. What's wrong with the internet?
Yeah, but you guys come from Australia where the internet is very slow.
It is super slow. It's crazy.
And you got to pay to get internet access in coffee shops. What is with that?
Well, it's improving, I have to say. Hotels, though, even here, still charge for Wi-Fi. I mean, what is going on with that? But I think our tolerance for that is shifting as well. People are going, hang on a second. And, you know, we're obviously in the connected world we're seeing. It just means that people can vent more easily. There's more space. So our expectations are rising, you know. Mm. And, you know, again, with this behavior design for businesses, the problem is there's often an expectation gap for people.
Yep.
And once upon a time, that gap didn't matter so much. It was invisible or people just put up with it. You know, companies spend millions of dollars running campaigns that say, our customer service is excellent. And the problem is every time you go into a store and you don't have an excellent experience,
right,
you're disappointed.
Yeah.
It's actually worse than if they said nothing.
Yeah.
So we call that an expectation gap.
Yeah, and that wasn't that part of the Ryanair philosophy? Is that tell you how terrible they are all the time? And
well,
then
they're
have
in
a good experience.
Court at the moment, aren't they? I think I saw that possibly. There's a huge lawsuit about making things right for their customers have to wait so long at the moment going on over in Europe. So, yeah, I think that, you know, the impatience is one of the huge shifts we're seeing. And you know, the other shift is obviously from private to public.
Mm.
So, you know, that a different sense of sharing. You know, we want to matter. Again, those fundamental drivers. We want to matter. Right. We want to stand out. We want to be heard.
Right.
And we now are seeing, you know, people sharing their lunch and breakfast and I think oversharing. You know, I want Facebook to put an overshare
Speak
button
for
on.
Yourself.
I don't know. I think Brett actually shared some breakfast. We unfriend people.
It was my lunch. So let me ask you guys a question here. You know, we talk a lot in banking about changing engagement, and the industry as a whole has been fascinated by this concept of the branch of the future. And trying to, you know, I guess the thinking might be, well, Apple gets plenty of people into their store, so if we just put some nice technology in our stores, that people will come. But I have a different theory on this, and I'd like your, you know, as sort of behavioral strategist, I'd like your theory on this. My theory is that the reason people aren't visiting bank branches anymore is they just don't need to, and it's not a design problem of the physical space. So you guys want to give some comments?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. I mean, you know, our lives live in our pockets now. And I think that's true to a large extent. Although, having said that, you know, when I set up our original business account, and this is going back 5 years ago, I walked past a Bankwest branch, which is a branch out of Western Australia. And it was completely different to all other banks. It was laid out more like an Apple store. You know, it's you walked into the space, there was no counter, there were no security screens. Yep. You walked into a space, there was a concierge who managed you through the process and introduced you to the people that you needed to. And that was a really interesting experience. They weren't on my list.
Yep.
You know, I was looking at a different range of banks to set up the business account. Now, their products lived up to the alternative promise that was part of the physical space. So I think, you know, it's a mix of both. You know,
but having said that...
Yes.
So I'm presuming you went with them as a provider.
I did in the end, yes.
Okay. So then, now that you went with them, does that mean now you visit their branch more often?
Well, see, I think that's an interesting question. And the truth is no.
Right.
Because, you know, we do all of our banking, you know, with either on our phones or online. In fact, I mean, one of the interesting things about being in the United States is the number of people who still pay using a check.
It's absurd. I know.
I mean, I don't think I've seen a check in Australia in a decade. And, you know, and I've, you know,
run
a number
of the world's checks are written in the United States. So.
Yeah, so it's really interesting to me that, you know, and obviously, you know, I travel a lot in Asia, as does Kieran, and Europe, and there are a lot more, you know, this is anecdotally, there seem to be a lot more old school banking practices in the United States, things like, you know, sending someone a piece of paper with your promise on it, than you see in somewhere like Asia. You know, I think there's a more of an early adopting culture, and they're more, and again, as Kieran was saying earlier, amongst digital natives, there's a greater propensity to see that, you know, the idea that your bank is something that you carry with you and is immediately with you wherever you are. So I think that is a big change.
So I've been trying to use the scared strategy with checks and explaining to Americans that check, the word check actually comes from the Persian or Iranian word sak, because it was developed in the first century on the Silk Road as a bill of exchange by the Persians. It hasn't worked though. They still use them.
Let me give you a history lesson on ancient Persian. We'll see if that changes your behavior. I'm not sure that's what I'd go with.
Okay, well, Dan Gregory and Kieran Flanagan, thanks for joining us today. Just give us a quick plug again for the book. Where can people find out about it? What it's called?
Okay, the book is called Selfish, Scared and Stupid. You can find the book at selfishscaredandstupid.com.
Or you can Google it.
It's on Amazon, amazing, I'm sure.
Right? It's on Amazon. Yeah.
It is.
It's in bookshops.
It's in bookshops.
There's hardly any bookshops.
What's a bookshop?
Because who wants to go to a bookshop?
Yeah. Okay, great. Dan Gregory, Kieran Flanagan, thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks.
Thank you, Brett.
Yeah, thanks very much, Brett King, our roving correspondent. And now it's time for one of those things that we always have to do on radio. It's the ad break.
When you're looking for the right place to eat, there's an app for that. When you need directions getting there, there's an app for that. And if you're trying to make a healthy choice, there's an app for that. But what about an app that tells you how you're doing with your money? Now, there's an app for that. It's called Moovin, a free app and debit account that automatically tracks your spending. You get real-time feedback with every purchase you make and a debit account with no overdraft or monthly fees. So if you want to stay on track with your money, download the Moovin app for free on iPhone or Android and check out Moovin.com. That's M-O-V-E-N.com.
The successful businesses of today do everything they can to meet the needs of their customers. But outdated IT systems mean that banks often struggle to offer the same level of personalized service. SunTech is working with some of the world's leading banks to help them provide the products, offers, and services that their customers need and want. Visit suntechgroup.com to find out more. That's suntechgroup.com.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase, and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
Your bank's customers expect comprehensive, convenient, and consistent service when and where they need it. A mobile app is a great start, but with so many devices and operating systems out there, it can be hard to keep up with demand. That's why today's leading banks count on the Kony Multichannel Experience Cloud. With Kony, you can design, develop, and manage multi-channel apps from one integrated platform. Build an app once, and with one click, you can deploy it securely across all digital channels, phones, tablets, desktop, and more. That means more efficient
efficiency for you and a better experience for your customers. Want to get to market fast? Explore Kony's range of ready-to-run apps, including retail, commercial, and private banking, with features like person-to-person transfers, targeted campaigns, built-in integrations, and cutting-edge compliance. Kony apps provide the framework and flexibility you need to rise above the competition. Go beyond first-generation mobile banking. Visit Kony.com/BK to launch your multi-channel strategy. That's KONY.com/BK. You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. I'm Andy McLean, sitting in for your regular host, Brett King, who's on a silent meditation retreat here in Bali. But leading up to that, he spoke to Dan Kimmerling, the Chief Everything Officer at a company called Standard Treasury. It's actually a company I know a little bit about. I spoke to Dan, about 6 months ago now, and he explained to me in the most simplest way about what APIs are all about and what banking needs to do to change. And basically he said to me, Andy, banking is an analog business, and they try to build digital processes on top of that. It doesn't work. Digital and analog are completely separate, and banks have to start thinking like that. And so that's basically what Standard Treasury is trying to do. They're a startup from the United States. They're doing quite well meeting companies and working with banks in the United Kingdom. I know that for certain because that's where I was based at the time. But this week, Brett King spoke to Dan Kimmerling, and we're going to listen to that interview now.
Standard Treasury raised $2.7 million earlier this year to help banks deliver digital services. But as part of this, attached with this funding and part of their rollout, there's been some interesting announcements and news about what Standard Treasury has planned this year. So I thought it'd be a great opportunity to get on with Dan Kimmerling, who is leads the team, CEO of, you just call yourself Chief Executive, Dan, don't you?
I also call myself Chief Everything Officer because, you know, if we need to order snacks or clean the office, you know, it just has to get done.
Welcome to Startupville, right?
Exactly.
So, welcome to the show. Where are you speaking to us from today?
Today I'm in San Francisco.
Okay, but Standard Treasury is based in the UK, am I correct?
It's sort of complicated, but we have our primary office is in San Francisco. Although we're in the middle of building out a presence in the UK right now.
So tell us about your plans, because you mentioned to me before we started the interview that you guys are going down the process of establishing your own charter. And just for those who aren't familiar with Standard Treasury, tell us a little bit about the business, how you got started, and where it's going now.
Of course. So my co-founder and I, we both worked at FinServe and FinTech companies beforehand. My co-founder worked at Stripe, the credit card processor, and I helped run a prepaid card company called Giftway. And at both Stripe and Giftway, even though they're on different sides of the value chain, we noticed that the quality of the banks that we had to work with was low, and also the technology interfaces that those banks provided was it left a lot to be desired. So where we actually started the company was by helping major banks to offer APIs and to really help them with a lot of the technology issues associated with partnering with applications in the fintech ecosystem. You know, we worked with several of the major banks, and we were part of the Fintech Innovation Lab.
So you already have established banks as clients, right?
Yeah, we actually built and sold our software to several major banks. But we actually have discontinued that product because we think the bigger opportunity is to go full stack and become our own API-driven wholesale bank. You know, when you look at the last, I don't know, 6 or so years since the financial crisis, what you've seen is the rise of a non-bank financial services company. You know, Brett, yeah. You've written about this, you know, for years now.
Sure.
But every one of those non-banks has to work with one or more banks for a variety of reasons, the least of which is regulatory. And so there's an opportunity to create a purpose-built institution to help the non-bank financial services companies get to market faster, manage their risk and compliance, and build really great companies. And what you really come to see is that there's an opportunity at the infrastructure layer to become the infrastructure bank for all of the non-bank players who are pulling share away from traditional banks.
So, I mean, I get this, but given that your work previously with sort of helping other banks, particularly with this API layer stuff, why wouldn't you just take one of those banks and, you know, retool them so that they could provide this role? Why start from scratch?
Yeah, I think when you look at the banks, what you really come down to is that, you know, the technology is older than you or I, Brett. That's the first thing.
And that's pretty old.
Yeah. that's the first thing. I think the second thing is the culture of most banks is an anathema to the way that, you know, I think the culture of many of these fintech applications. You know, I often say that the biggest problem with banks is that they're run by bankers, yep, not by software engineers. And then I think the third thing is that many of these banks have a sort of cultural aversion to understanding that technology is their future. Many big banks, and small banks for that matter, see that technology is a risk and cost center. Yep. Whereas when we see it, we actually see that technology is the future of banks. That banking is largely, you know, a business of ones and zeros, and that that's the future of banking.
So you guys have recently applied to be an independent UK bank.
We're in the process of.
So how long do you expect it before you can definitively let us know what your plans are in terms of the launch in the UK?
We can probably speak with a higher degree of confidence in a couple of months. And once we do, we'll be happy to talk more about our rollout in the UK.
And
we would love to.
And at that point, you're going to apply everything that you've learned working with your other clients in terms of things like fraud detection and payments capability,
risk management,
yeah, intelligent lending algorithms and things like that. And you're going to build that into your own API layer. Are you going to actually offer this to wholesale clients, or is it more going to be you are going to be the bank platform for neobanks and others that want to serve this market?
I actually see those as both falling under the wholesale umbrella, right? We want to power the neobanks, and we want to power the non-bank specialty lenders, and we want to power the Nutmegs and Wealthfronts of the world as they take on the asset management arms of these big banks. So really, anyone that is building that branded end mile experience, the last mile experience, we want to be their bank partner of choice.
Very good. And in the announcement that you guys had last year around the raise, I noticed it was interesting in the Wall Street Journal cover that RRE said part of the reason they invested in you guys was the technical competence of the founders, yourself and Zach and Brent, I think, as well. So, you know, how much of these decisions you're making are technology-led and customer experience-led versus, you know, just trying to fix a bank from the ground up?
I'd say 90%+ is in the first bucket.
Yeah.
I think whenever you work with an existing bank, you always have to change the vision to accommodate the needs of the bank instead of the bank as the supplier helping to enable the vision of the end of the partner.
Yep.
And ultimately, one of the reasons why we've decided to stop working with incumbent banks is because even just helping them open APIs led to a really watered-down API experience.
Yeah, because their capability behind that was the limiting factor. All right, Dan. Well, listen, how do people find out a bit more information about Standard Treasury?
They can either look at standardtreasury.com or follow us on Twitter at Standard API.
Fantastic. And I also noticed in your team. You got on the website. You have a software engineer with the name Jarvis. Does he speak with a British accent?
No, but he carries a British passport, which is very.
Oh, there beautiful. You go. Now I was thinking of Tony Stark Jarvis.
it's a obscure but nerdy reference. I love it.
There you go. Dan Kimmeling from Standard Treasury, the chief of everything. Thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks.
Thank you very much, Brett.
That was Brett King speaking to Dan Kimmeling. Now we're going to go to an interview that actually I recorded while I was sick the other week, so excuse my voice, but it's with DJ Dodonna, the founder of a startup, EFL Global, which works with psychometric credit scoring. I met him in a rice paddy here in Bali.
This week we're in Southeast Asia once again with Breaking Banks, and I'm speaking with DJ Dodonna, who I actually met in Bali last weekend at in a rice field of all places. But you can never quite know where you meet some of the people that are connected to the fintech world. DJ's involved with a company called EFL. DJ, why don't you just tell us a little bit about what your company does and how its credit scoring model works?
Sure. So EFL stands for the Entrepreneurial Finance Lab. It started as a research initiative at Harvard to try to figure out how to lend to the missing middle, so micro and small and medium-sized enterprises across the emerging world. The approach that we took from a research standpoint was information. In a world where there's scarce information, credit bureaus, formal financial statements, borrowing history, how do you analyze which borrower is good, which borrower isn't good? And the solution we came up with is using psychometrics. So the same sort of information you'd use for pre-employment screening or pre-interviewing. We did research on applying to whether or not someone's personality, their characteristics, their honesty and ethics, business skills and intelligence would make them a good business person and a good credit risk, so that banks can lend money in these environments where there's not a lot of information about them.
Okay, and what markets are you focusing on at the moment?
In the initial research was across Latin America and Sub-Saharan Africa. We've since grown the company to operate in about 15 markets across Central America, South America, East and South Africa, South Asia, so India, Pakistan, and then Indonesia. And Indonesia, because of the massive size of the market and the acceleration kind of adoption of access to finance here, has been one of our fastest performing ones.
Okay, so you're based in Jakarta then, are you?
I'm based most of the year in Boston. I spend a lot of time traveling between our markets because we're so geographically spread out.
Oh, well, it was just a nice coincidence you're in Bali the other week. And you're still around and we can have this interview. But just tell me a little bit more about, how successful is the psychometric approach?
So when we originally started, the conception was where there's no information, we could create information. So basically quantifying something that banks typically try to figure out by sending out their loan officers to get a qualitative assessment. And so we've been quite successful in that realm. So think of the unbanked, the underbanked, new-to-bank population that financial institutions don't know how to measure. Mm-hmm. We've been quite successful in that realm. We have also been quite successful in areas with more kind of penetrated access to finance. So Peru, for example, is one of the most highly penetrated microfinance markets in the world. It's got great bureaus. It has a long history of access to finance success. However, what one of the leading bureaus, Equifax, has done there is it's taken information that they have, so past repayment history, and then also added on information about the individual. So not only what they've done in the past, but what kind of characteristics they have that will make them successful in the future. And it's enabled them to offer about 40 to 50% more applicants to a bank. So successful across actually both regions.
Gee, that's a big number, isn't it, in terms of the step up and people able to access credit. I guess the next question, I suppose, is, do you see banks in other countries, where, let's take England as an example, which is the most relevant one to me, where, you've just none of this sort of thing's being used as far as I'm aware, and so many people are unable to get credit, because of the standard models. Do you see the, sort of the high street banks, following this sort of approach or working with you?
So I'll say that we've had a lot of interest from banks in more developed markets. it's really been more of our own strategic concern that, that we've stayed in the more developing world. We've got a partnership globally with MasterCard to help their credit originators identify high potential entrepreneurs. And so we've had interest in places like Europe and the States because, and the whole premise of this kind of program, right, is that banks are looking at the same set of information that they've looked at for decades. Meanwhile, there's a tremendous amount of information being created about individuals, whether it's their activity on social networks, their usage of mobile phones and payments, or, you know, more about their characteristics and personality. In the United States, for example, there's tens of millions of individuals that, that don't even have credit scores. So recent immigrants, they might have a credit score in Canada or the UK, but it doesn't apply over when they come for grad school or whatnot. Or they don't have the kind of fundamental ingredients to build that up. That doesn't mean they're not credit worthy.
Well, DJ, look, thanks very much for joining us. It sounds like a fascinating project. And now it's back to Breaking Banks.
Thanks so much, Andy.
Gosh, my voice sounded absolutely terrible on that interview. So hopefully it sounds better today live. We're coming up to the end of the show here on Breaking Banks, but it would never be the same without our moment of snark. Goodbye, and here is Ron Shevlin.
Right now, in ad agency conference rooms everywhere, someone is sharing the same brilliant idea. Hey, let's do a survey of Gen Yers. We'll ask questions that really get to the heart and core of what they're about, and we'll demonstrate to brands that we really get millennials. One recent study, apparently so important that it warranted two separate articles in Media Post, revealed the following insights into the deep and mysterious Gen Y psyche. 8 of 10 Gen Yers said that they want their lives to have as much meaning as possible. Apparently, and I'm quoting from the study, the desire for fun, meaning, and happiness distinguishes Gen Y from Gen X. 3/4 of Gen Yers said that they understand people's flaws and accept them. 72% said that life is too short to be uptight. And 7 of 10 Gen Yers agreed with the statement, I'm a realist. How precious. The generation that overwhelmingly voted for hope thinks that they're realists. But how despicable and cranky are Gen Xers that they apparently don't want fun, meaning, and happiness in their lives? And I guess that boomers like me believe that life is plenty long to be uptight. You know, there ought to be a law in market research. Thou shalt publish no research about a generation if the study doesn't include respondents of other generations for comparative purposes. But as a realist and a pragmatist, I recognize that this is likely to go unheeded, because I know marketing agencies are starved for press attention. I understand their flaws, and I accept them. But if agencies are going to conduct Gen Y studies, the least they could do is ask them how their attitudes are changing. The oldest Gen Yers are already in their mid-30s. In 5 years, they'll hit 40. 40 is a lot different than 20, no? Are their attitudes and attributes changing? Are Gen Yers becoming more like older generations, just as we older generations were more like Gen Yers when we were younger? If you're going to survey Gen Yers, ask questions that help us learn something useful about this generation. And that's this week's Moment of Snark on Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern time on the Voice America Business Channel. We'll explore more changes and challenges next week.